Hi everyone, welcome to an extra broadcast for our virtual ILS NYC event. We were due to finish yesterday, but a number of things have now fallen into place and I'm delighted to bring you just one more. So we're continuing to look at the development of the insurance-linked securities market, always with one eye to the future. And this year, as our theme has been for the last 12 broadcasts, we're focusing on defining the next generation of ILS. Given that theme, the recent launch of a new startup focused on the insurance sector named OTT Risk aligned a lot of stars and aligned very closely with my own thinking on the future of the marketplace. OTT Risk wants to tackle the massive societal issues around availability of insurance capacity for business interruption to begin with, something that has come to a head with the pandemic in the last year. And OTT hopes to enhance the economic resilience of the world's businesses by filling the gap for coverage that exists there using advanced technologies such as machine learning and by leveraging insurance-linked securities investors to connect this emerging risk class with capital market investors. So I was particularly pleased when the founders agreed to a discussion, and so I welcome David Soloff and Chamath Palihapitiya. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thanks for including us, Steve.
Sure, it's great to have you. So, Chamath, perhaps I could start with you. Why business interruption? It makes perfect sense to people like myself who spend our days deep in risk and insurance-linked securities, but you look in from a much broader world of ventures. And what made this a problem worth spending time on?
I'd love to tell you sort of two dimensions of the answer. The first is actually sort of from a moral perspective and ethical perspective, which is that if anything, during this pandemic, we've seen how precarious and how fragile the infrastructure is that supports small and medium enterprises. In fact, you know, all of the mechanisms that the United States government has deployed in order to try to save and sort of like, you know, give some stopgaps, financial support to folks that have been affected by the pandemic have not been very successful. And then the downstream impact of that is that I actually think it frays communities. Because when you don't have this essential cartilage of small and medium enterprises, what you really lose is the fabric that keeps, you know, cities and towns operational and functional. So from a simple perspective of just how society works, we need to give these entities a more secure way of reliably knowing that in the future, come what may, that there is a downside protection that they have bought. You know, that rainy day insurance that can come in. And then from a more quantitative perspective, I think that we are slowly understanding that this next sort of 10 or 15 years is going to be incredibly complicated. I'll give you a few examples. Imagine you're a business that is subject to disinformation. And imagine that, you know, all kinds of things are written about you from the context of industrial espionage or from, you know, a disgruntled employee. And all of a sudden it triggers all kinds of issues for you, whether it's customer rejection, customer reevaluation, churn, protests, who knows? What do you do? How do you protect yourself? How can you find mechanisms to make sure that, you know, your business isn't interrupted or to the extent that it is, you're protected? A different example. You know, if you believe now that climate change regulation is going to only escalate in its severity, which I think it will, I think the terminal endpoint of all of that is going to be carbon taxation. Now, imagine that every single company has to deploy sensors. And imagine that those sensors get hacked so that there's a cybersecurity threat to you. And all of a sudden, you know, your carbon footprint is 10 times larger than you thought it was because of some malfeasance. What do you do? Those are just two extremely simple, and I think for most people, obvious examples of how the next 10 or 15 years creates business complexity for organizations. And so when David, you know, had this idea and he said, you know what, you know, would you want to partner with me to do it? I kind of jumped at the chance to experiment and find technical solutions to what are otherwise intractable problems of business.
And you've just explained the real purpose of insurance in the first place, which is something the industry has never been all that good at talking about itself. David, moving over to you, you've got a track record with companies supplying data analytics services to insurance and reinsurance markets. And so perhaps for our less savvy technically savvy readers and viewers, perhaps you could explain the thesis behind using artificial intelligence and machine learning to make more sense of data.
Sure. Thanks for having us. I think that, you know, the concept here is very similar to other companies I've been fortunate enough to found. We live in an information and data abundant environment. And so naturally, one should spend a lot of time and effort trying to understand, index, and sort of tease out the really evident truths about what's happening, what's going to happen. Frequently, they're hiding in plain sight. There's a massive, massive amount of public domain, publicly accessible information of all forms, structured and unstructured, textual and quantitative, image-based and the like. And in many of those sources, there has not really been a systematic effort placed on evaluating what these pieces of information tell us about risk. You've got it now that's it's endemic to some of the online platforms where they police themselves. And so you've got the beginnings of this, and that's really out of existential or business necessity. The financial markets obviously have quite a history of synthesizing benchmarks for both betting, forecasting, hedging, and the like. But no one has really done this with the exception of the climate markets in the insurance space. And so what started for me as an intellectual exercise a couple of years ago, specifically thinking about political and social risk, and as Chamath mentioned, misinformation, disinformation, and the really massively outsized impact it is going to have, especially as a magnifier or accelerator of other problems, be they health problems or social inequality. No one had really thought about using new approaches and new sources of data to forecast or to help individuals risk manage. A cool idea intellectually, but not very practical from a business perspective. And then you have a pandemic. And all of a sudden, what you see is, while there's been a massive amount of focus on the initial displacing event, the thing that causes everyone to sit up and say, oh my goodness, what has really happened is more of a slow moving economic catastrophe at the mid and long tail. And as Chamath mentioned, it is disproportionately impacting the people who can least afford the insurance and most need it. So into that breach, what we're trying to do is take what was once kind of an intellectual or abstract approach and say, what is the likelihood of certain large scale displacements happening? What is the macroeconomic impact that has followed those historically? And given our understanding now, how can we forecast the likelihood in the near term? How can we understand how a specific industry or business is being impacted given one and two? And how can we begin to put a structure around pricing, quantifying, and ultimately helping to transfer that risk? How that manifests is as insurance products that are really meaningful.
That's fascinating. And so that kind of describes the problem and some of the technology you're going to leverage to try and solve it. So Chamath, OTT's business model is to really aggregate the risk and through using technology and putting understanding and pricing and quantifying the exposures, and then distributing it. And you've targeted the capital markets as a source of the capacity for that. What made that seem the right solution to you?
Well, I think that, you know, where we don't want to be is sort of some esoteric niche product that is viewed only experimentally. But I think that we also acknowledge the fact that in order for us to bring credibility, scale, depth, and liquidity to this market so that it can be properly securitized and syndicated, we need the capital markets as true functionary partners. How do we do that? David and I just realized that, you know, this is not going to happen in the absence of he and I writing the risk ourselves, writing cover ourselves, and frankly, just realizing that the first tens of millions of dollars here will be, you know, experimental risk capital. And that's effectively our beta. And I think in that, what I think we're going to learn are two really important things. Number one, obviously, is sort of what are the boundary conditions of this cover and where do we actually, you know, where have we gotten the risk pricing right? Where have we gotten it wrong that we need to iterate? How can we make sure that, as David said, these new mechanisms of learning are informing how intelligently we can think about pricing this risk? But then the second is that how performant can it be and predictably performant can it be such that we can sort of partner with traditional, you know, institutions and fixed income books and, you know, other folks with large balance sheets of capital who want to own the kind of paper that we can generate. Mm-hmm. And so if we can do that, again, by obviously first being the, you know, the leading edge and being willing to lose the first N, you know, millions of dollars, although I hope we don't, but I'm just saying in the worst case, if we do, the byproduct will be much more predictable. And I think then that we can, you know, pull the full faith and security of social capital and our balance sheet behind David and OTT to basically tell other folks that, you know, we believe in this financial product. And I think that that imbuing of, you know, reputational credibility can be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. And that's a powerful thing as well, when you're willing to put your own skin in the game, and particularly when you're taking first dollar losses like that, because it is an education thing with the insurance, reinsurance and the ILS industry with any new risk or peril or new way of structuring that. David, you're coming at a problem that the broader insurance industry right now are almost excluding their way out of in any renewal contracts, which obviously presents an opportunity to anybody who can break their way into that segment. But also, I guess I'm interested to know what makes you feel you can put enough understanding around some of these risks to make it possible to price it and to get the investor buy-in behind it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think trying to approach this with a measure of humility is going to be extremely important. And we've tried to bring that so far. We've, especially over the last month, we've been speaking with a lot of people in the industry, insurers, reinsurers, brokers, cedents, and having the flexibility to understand and listen to what people have tried in the past, what has and has not worked, is very important. I think that's one of the lessons I've learned a lot as an entrepreneur. You know, you require the fierce passion to approach things very differently and in a way that might seem pretty heterodox. But what I've also learned is you need to be adaptive and recognize what people have tried and learn from them and listen to them. It's very easy to exclude people's experience. These are going to be your customers and partners. So you absolutely have to understand, and I've had to understand and do, it's not like we invented business interruption cover, or it's not like NDBI isn't a problem people know they need to deal with, right? So I'm approaching it, and we're approaching it that way. And that's actually helped inform a number of our early takes on the product. I guess what I would say is that insurance historically has been a retroactively focused mechanism. It looks to the past. It builds its models based on what's happened historically to essentially handicap the likelihood of something happening now and in the immediate term. And that makes a ton of sense, provided there's continuity between the historical model and the present model and what's likely to happen in the future. I think for hundreds of years, that's probably been a very, very good business. Unfortunately, I think the gig's up a little bit. And certainly it's been the case in the climate realm, as I mentioned earlier. You've now got a hybrid approach where you're looking historically, but you're also beginning from the point of understanding that right now, what has happened historically is not what is happening now and is highly unlikely to be what happens in the future. We're not going back to some pattern that we once saw. It's important to understand that historically, but you need to cast it and recast it in a new volatility regime. You need to say, okay, what is my multiplier now, given everything I am seeing that is changing? And how does that influence my historical model? So how do I build a hybrid approach? I've taken a lot of encouragement from what the folks at Nephila have done. You know, I've had the really good fortune to spend a lot of time talking to Barney Schauble. I mean, I think what he and his team have done is really, really important for the industry, well beyond climate. So given that, how can we take this understanding to looking at what were once considered and continue to be considered by many completely uninsurable because of their scope and systemic nature and scale and size? A couple of things. One, I think building a multi-peril framework for understanding the true frequency of these events in the past is a critical starting point. I mean, we recognize that these events as sort of cat-type binary trigger events don't happen incredibly frequently, but when they do, they're quite large. I think the harder problem is, what about these non-cat but devastating events? You know, it's not the pandemic, which happens once every N decades. It's the epidemic that happens far more frequently. So the approach we're taking is by named peril, by macroeconomic sector, by microeconomic industry sector, and by the cedent in their geography. So what you're doing at each step of the parametric framework, without going too deep into it, you are narrowing the basis risk and you're structuring a transaction that makes sense for the individual counterparty rather than for the entirety of an industry. Economically and otherwise, that's so problematic. If our first proposed transaction requires $1 billion of collateral, it's not going to happen. It needs to maybe require $5 or $7 million of collateral or less. So that's when you start getting to a pinpoint solution that can accurately and helpfully insure an individual.
Mm. And yeah, a product like this is certainly going to be attractive to a wide range of cedents potentially. And actually, it seems that the way you're approaching this, and maybe I could direct this to Chamath, it's been very hard for the industry to quantify things like non-damage business interruption in the past. I guess the technology hasn't been there, but also the perhaps the way of approaching the issue has not been as greenfield as perhaps it needs to be. But do you see read across from the way you're addressing that to other areas of sort of intangible risk as well? So the world obviously is made up of intangible value these days, and the industry does not really address that particularly well right now. It's seen as a big opportunity.
In fact, I think it's probably the next most adjacent area to go to. So, you know, one area that I've always thought about is like, what is the derivative of disinformation, as an example, or what is the derivative of cyber security threat, or, you know, for example, what is the derivative of other forms of damage business interruption? And I think how I would tell you and characterize it from a more financial lens is that it impacts goodwill. Mm. And, you know, that's a very complicated thing. So what is goodwill insurance? You know, what would that look like? What does it mean, for example, if Nike made a climate pledge and it looked like not only did they not meet it and they were spewing emissions, that they also had child labor, and all of a sudden, the brand impact was meaningful and somewhat catastrophic. So I do think that where we're going, in many ways, look, I think what technology does at its best is it takes the realm of the impossible and pulls it into the possible. And we've done that now in many of the physical sciences. You know, we can send rockets all over the, into all kinds of different heights. We can create all kinds of crazy important things that effectively, you know, we can send rockets back down and land them on a drone barge. These things seemed like science fiction and now they're real. And so this surface area of stuff should be tractable. And so I just think that I go back to where I started, which is that, look, we have a reasonable starting point where we ourselves will be the risk capital to prove that it's possible. And in success, Steve, our ambition and our aspiration is to move to these other adjacent areas so that we can give businesses a complete holistic all-in-one solution. Those could be sold and productized in many different ways. But I think, you know, as I've talked to David about this, our ambition is, you know, pretty much unlimited. It'll be bounded by two things. Number one is our risk appetite and making sure that we are willing to, again, put our money where our mouth is first. And number two is the quality of the data scientists and machine learning people we hire and our ability to give them freedom to operate. Because again, the critical thing in this is to let them explore, let them be experimental, let them run scenarios and let them build learning models where they theoretically could be wrong, because that is probably the best way to get the knowledge, which will then allow them to be right.
Mm. And there's going to be no shortage of potential areas to explore as well, I feel. It's such a hot topic right now, anything in the intangibles, the reputation world and things like that in the industry and obviously wider commerce right now. David, the plan at OTT is offering sort of deep capacity, unlocking sort of the capital markets to enable you to give reinsurance or retrocession to carriers and enable them to provide the products, therefore, on the front end to customers. It sounds really good in theory, and it's obviously going to be very challenging, and we've talked about some of those challenges, but what do you feel you need to overcome in terms of, I guess, how you will interface with the industry on this, and are there any other major hurdles you foresee?
There's no shortage of major hurdles, actually. as much as I'd like to say there are very few that I can see, I think it's pretty much the opposite. There are three big ones that I've set for the team out of the gate. One, we need to match pricing with customers and industry expectations. I've heard everything from 5 basis points to 1,000 basis points as a reasonable starting point for this cover. So that right there tells you that we have some work to do. We're going to be starting in what is likely a niche. It's considered a niche. It has been historically. It's a niche solution. It's a bolt-on. It's an add-on. It's a layer, whatever, seemingly complementary but somewhat pejorative term you want to apply to it. So we need to bring some consensus on pricing, and there need to be a lot of constructive discussions with brokers, underwriters, and that's well underway since even your pieces from last week in Artemis and Reinsurance News, it's been unbelievable for us. I mean, I feel like we've learned 100 years worth of information and insight from some really, really fantastic counterparties, people are willing to share with us. It's been great. So one is matching pricing expectations with what customers in the industry expect and can bear. I think the second, and I sort of tipped this a little bit, we need to build an ecosystem of intermediaries and underwriters who really do believe in the approach. It's a different approach. It's going to require education of intermediaries, channel partners, or brokers. They're going to have to put in the work to understand it. We're going to have to be humble and listen to them and adapt and work with them. If we, we're not distributing everything ourselves, there's no way to build any sort of critical market scale if that's the approach. And I guess, the third, and maybe this is the first, because without it, nothing else happens. We need to get regulators on board with the pricing methodology and also our ambitions on the asset management side. Chamath referred to this earlier. I think just as the risk capital that we're putting to work will be ours, the asset management strategy, which if it performs as we hope, will effectively subsidize or be a buy down on the cost of the insurance. It's critical that we get both sides of these working. And so from a regulatory and ALM or asset liability matching approach, there's a lot of complexity there. We do have the advantage of really sophisticated partners and team members who've got a lot of quantitative and investing experience. We understand the challenges there. So having a meaningful dialogue, for instance, with the regulators in Bermuda, or helping them understand that collateralization is going to allow us perhaps to take on more risk on both sides of the balance sheet. I don't know how those conversations are going to go, quite honestly. So that's, that's a very, very significant set of hurdles. But ultimately, I think making people understand that our objective is to add significant value to society, as absurd as that sounds, that's really the goal. And is there a way to build a profitable and scalable business doing that? Absolutely. There's really no reason why not. As a matter of fact, I was talking with someone earlier about ESG incentives having been traditionally and historically contrary to each other. If you're focusing on ESG initiatives, somehow that's anti-business. And I wouldn't say that they're directly parallel now, but they're, they're getting to be more and more adjacent. So you actually are seeing outperformance among companies that are responsive and thinking this way. Similarly, from a capital participation perspective, having capital that wants to underwrite an ESG product and help enable resilience is a fantastic value proposition. Can we make it work economically? We're going to try.
Yeah, those large ESG allocators are really looking for opportunities like this. Obviously,
it's a supply demand problem. There's a lack of supply.
Yeah,
look at Tesla. I mean, that's what that is. The money wants to go to a scalable, an environmentally human society scalable solution. There's a reason it's trading the way it is. That's the biggest ESG play I can think of.
Yeah. No, it's we've had a number of sessions in this conference that have been focused on ESG, and it's clear that the ILS market sees an opportunity there, but at the moment they can't produce the product in the way that the big allocators need it or in the volume that they need either. So Chamath, turning back to you, obviously one of the challenges getting capital market investors on side with your pricing and models, but with technology, I'm a firm believer that you can wrap understanding around risk and get to a place where you can find the layers that make sense for specific investors. But do you feel with the right technology, the appetite for this could go much deeper than we currently perceive the ILS market to be?
Yeah, in fact, I think David actually did maybe just to connect these last two thoughts. You know, right now, asset and liability management, in my opinion, is a little constrained. And I think that we can open the aperture of that. I think the downstream implication for our success is that what we are really selling is ESG insurance. It manifests in all of these different mechanisms. And, you know, NDBI, I think, is sort of upcoded to ESG actually at scale. So in that, I do think that there are a lot of organizations. Obviously, there's the traditional, you know, insurance companies and asset managers that need to own, you know, sort of this kind of sort of predictable paper once it's securitized properly. But I do think that there are all kinds of other organizations that will want to own it for completely different reasons. Again, going back to the beginning of how we started, there's going to be a lot of people, even individuals, who, given the choice of owning, you know, a piece of paper from a fossil fuel emitter super major at 4 or 5%, or, you know, 4 or 5% paper that you know, is backed from you know, the support of small and medium-sized businesses. I mean, I just think that that's pretty like obvious what people would want to own. And, you know, it's going to be for us, again, after many years of iteration and risk management and, you know, and risk taking, to reframe what this is as, you know, basically ESG. And this is true form of ESG, because you can really now underwrite and write cover against environmental and societal and governance related issues. And I think that's an extremely powerful, very disruptive idea. And I think in that, the capital markets get blown wide open. Just to give you a sense, Steve, ESG fund inflows on both the debt and equity side are going to top $1 trillion probably by 2030, and probably will be $2 trillion. And I think it becomes the preeminent lens through which, you know, capital allocation will happen, especially, again, as you start to see all kinds of ESG forms of regulation and taxation at the state, federal, provincial, and local levels across the world. So this is the new frontier of how companies will have to manage their go-to-market and their, you know, future cash flows and their valuations.
Mm, no, that's fascinating. It's such an enormous opportunity to unlock some of that capital and actually put it to work in really responsible way as well. David, I think we'll close down with you briefly. We've spoken before about sort of what you need to do in terms of the relationships you need to build, and you've mentioned some of that today. But what would you say to our viewers who are from the industry? How should they be thinking about OTT risk, and what can they do to support you guys as you venture down this path?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question. You know, I actually recall last year at this time, I was in New York at your event in February of 20, just as things were changing dramatically. You know, that was pretty much the last gasp, I think. And I remember being there and gestating this idea and still not knowing quite where to place it or how to enact it. And there were so many of your speakers and folks that I knew, both in the audience and on stage there. And it's funny, I have the sensation of wanting to talk with all of them about this great idea, but recognizing I still didn't fully understand, like, the dress it was going to wear. Like, I just, there wasn't that final 20 or 30%, like the event and the sort of tangible, recognizable risk that people had been talking about and were living through. It hadn't erupted yet. And then it did. And so it's just personally really gratifying to be here and talking to your viewers. And, you know, I, as they say on talk radio, you know, long time listener, first time caller, everybody who's watching this and all of your subscribers, like, it's not the biggest list in the world, but there's pretty much like 98% overlap with the people I want to talk to. So that's pretty great. It's really good targeted advertising. A few things. Please think of us as a technology provider enabled by capital, right? Like, we're bringing a technical approach, and we cannot enact it without the capital we've got, and also partner capital. We recognize we need to take the first loss, and we will. But that's not the end point for this. For this to really work and for there to be the capacity required, ILS and reinsurance capital is not going to be enough. You need private capital markets. You need, potentially in some scenarios and governments, public domain. You need public capital. The most likely way for that to happen is that there's a stub within the private markets that make it happen and reify it, turn it into a thing, and then everyone can jump on, private and public. And so we're really inspired to do that. We think also, you know, parametric structures are what is required. That doesn't mean we'll shy away from a hybrid parametric or an indemnification product. So we want to talk to corporates, insurers, reinsurers, alternative capital providers, data scientists, risk managers. It's an open call. Really, what we want to do is have forward-leaning partners who help us think through and enact how this product can work and help us get it into the market.
Mm. I think you'll probably find there'll be a few people trying to contact you after this, I would imagine. So as you said, most of the market is going to be watching, I hope. So hopefully they'll be in touch with you guys. Chamath, is there anything you'd like to add just before we close down this interview?
I just want to say, first of all, thank you for just giving us a chance to tell this story and asking us thoughtful questions. And I would just echo what David said. I've worked with David now for a decade. We worked before at one of his other startups that he started. You're not going to find a smarter, but also more thoughtful and experimental and iterative thinker in this space. And so I think that to the extent that people are curious, I would just encourage you to reach out to us. I think it's a wonderful culture and team that he's building, and that I think it's a great business we're trying to build together. So thank you for just allowing us to tell the story. And then I just want to say thanks to David as well for doing the hard work.
Sure. It's a great story, I think. And I look forward to watching as OTT Risk develops and potentially other initiatives off the back of it as well. But thank you both. Thank you, David. Thank you, Chamath. I really appreciate your time today. And I look forward to talking to you both again soon.
Thanks, Steve.
All the best to you.
Next time.